third part.
Interview was found out when it took place on the weekend, April 13th, 1988.
Okay, I have some questions about the work of Amish Mag in particular. Now, were U.S. officers who were with the Mag, were they assigned to work with specific Iranian military units? And how did this all work out in practice?
Somewhere before I went over there, let's think in terms of about 6 or 8 years, we had small teams down to division and lower. At that time, we would have a few U.S. officers assigned to work with the smaller units. As they developed and came along, we eliminated the lower-level trainers, as they were called, and advisors, and went only to division level. Later on, we lifted it again, went only to corps level. When I got over there, we had only the U.S. military personnel working at the central headquarters in Tehran, plus a field team, one in Esfahan, where they had a corps headquarters, and one in Shiraz, where we had a division and quite a few other units. Those field teams spread out and visited the units in their geographical area quite a bit. But by and large, they were advisors to the, what you might call, the middle-level Iranian commanders. Basically, about 85% of our people were at the Tehran headquarters.
What kind of work did they do at that level? Did most of the officers do?
We had my headquarters that was specifically working with the Iranian central headquarters, the joint headquarters, called the Imperial Army, meaning all three services staff. So I had that group, and in that group, of course, I had the personnel people, the intelligence people, the operations planning people, and the logistics people. That was with General Azhari. We were in the same building with him. We worked with him, him and his people, on a daily basis. In addition to that, I had an army section under General Patton. General Patton had his group still in Tehran, but in a building about two and a half miles from us in the Army headquarters building. General Price, Air Force, also was over at the Air headquarters, and Navy Captain Harwood was still in another building in the Navy headquarters. So we did work at their top level with about 85% of our people. Only a few hours were what we call out in the field. So that made a requirement for us out of the Tehran office to try to come there. I think I mentioned to you that I tried to get out of Tehran twice a week.
Now, one of the field teams that were stationed in Isfahan and Shiraz, what were their main activities?
Basically, they were the same activities we had, but at a lower level.
Yeah.
They had little groups of about 8 people. They worked with the commander and his staff and just the meetings.
Did they do any, what kind of work did they do in terms of when they worked with the Iranian officers? What kind of weapons training or
when we started, yeah. It was weapons training, individual training, small unit training, squads, platoons, companies, battalions. That's 6 or 8 years before. But by then, by the time I got there, it had lifted on the more or less the policy, the guidance basis. We did not have what you would generally refer to as trainers. We were more advisors than trainers. We did not conduct any specific classes, except periodically they would ask us to gather their leaders and explain a type subject. For instance, at one time we gathered about, 30 general officers and a good many lesser ranks, and had classes on what can a ground forces aviation capacity do for you, or capability do for you. What would you require of it? What could it do? We had some on how to integrate intelligence information into a military operation. When you start planning an operation, how do you approach the requirement for intelligence? When you decide what your intelligence effort needs, how do you go about getting the intelligence operators to respond to your request? In other words, we were working with how to work the G2 and the G3 together. G2's intelligence, G3's operations. How do we get those two to work together? We would get together with their logistics people and work with you as a logistician are required to ensure that the force is supplied, is maintained, and you're also charged with medical evacuation on it. So when an operational plan is being envisioned in the initial stages, here's what the logistician should be thinking about. How do you get your job done without just sitting back and reacting to requirements? If you do that, you will always be behind the power curve. You will always be hassling just to break even. But if you think your way through the operation in the initial stages, you may very well be ready to respond before the question's asked. That was our general approach.
How responsive were the Iranians to those kinds of suggestions?
I use the expression among my people a good many times. You've got to do your homework. You cannot give a snap judgment. The reason I did that is they trusted us to a fault. They believed everything we said to the point that we couldn't joke with them. We couldn't pull a trick on them just for fun. We had to just rule levity out, which is, you know, pretty hard for an American. But, If we ever said something, they took it at face value. To a fault, I repeat, to a fault, because if an American said it, they believed it. And they acted on it quite frequently.
That's interesting. Now, a minute ago, you were talking about intelligence organization, and in other interviews, you talked about the question of the need for more trained personnel, and we talked about arms sales a bit also. What other policy issues did you work with, did you work on?
Let's don't drop intelligence that quite that quickly.
Okay.
Because we had a bilateral agreement with Iran that was very, very specific. It was burned into my brain before I left Washington. The MAG is not an intelligence agent. We were absolutely forbidden to participate in intelligence activities. Nobody in the American establishment could put a demand on us for us to learn something, for us to find something. We were not in the intelligence business as far as trying to find out something they were doing or find out something that the Russians were doing in Iran, someone else doing it. Our military attache over in the embassy was charged with that. We weren't in on that.
I meant to say that you worked with Iranians in terms of military intelligence organization.
We worked on organizational establishments.
That's right. That's
we worked on how the things functioned. We worked on just the techniques of, as an example, we had a maneuver one time that I observed rather carefully, and it was very interested in it, in the intelligence field. I noticed that the intelligence people had gone through all the ritual, gone down just by rote, down the techniques and the things that we do and all that. And one of them, they asked for aerial photographs of the area immediately to their front. The flights were flown, the pictures were made and developed, the pictures were delivered, and the photographs were put in the desk. Nobody ever read them. Somehow or another, we just hadn't gotten to that yet. That you ask for them for a purpose. So the intelligence man had the information that the operations man wanted very badly. But it just sort of, there was a gap. There was a break. That was a simple thing, easy to correct. But they were learning. They had not grown up in what we call a sophisticated environment. And well, in my school, in my lesson, they told me to ask for the picture, and I got the picture, and I looked at the picture, and I put it in my dad and my father. But that was the approach. Part of it was very simple, some of it a little more complicated.
Now, you mentioned, I guess, the influence the American officers had on the Iranians in terms of pretending. So they listened to American advice closely, mm-hmm. or followed it closely. What impact did cultural differences have on the working relationship between Americans, American officers, and Iranian officers?
Well, when you think of the Iranian people, you have to realize that they, at that time, did not have much of a middle class. It was either the educated and cultured and the large masses. Most of the officers came from the relatively cultured groups. So the gap wasn't near as big as you would visualize it if you thought of the overall Iranian people. A major portion of their officers had at least short courses in the United States. A terrific number of them had been to Fort Benning, Fort Knox, you name it. 6-month courses as a rule, 6 to 10 month courses. And they had been exposed to a good bit. Over the years, they'd been exposed to American advisors, so it wasn't a subservient, it wasn't a second-class citizen approach at all. We worked together as friends, really, personal friends.
Did anybody on the Amish Mag staff have trouble working with Iranians in practice? Were there any difficulties in, you know, individual cases? Were there tensions or problems? Or?
I think probably during my time I had 400, 500, maybe 600 officers in and out and assigned. Mm-hmm. I think that's some total of 300. So it wasn't a problem. We were alert to that type trouble to the point that we were almost jumping, because we realized that if one of our people really went bad and did something that was atrocious, it would reflect on all of us. And the reflection would have been in the Iranians having their feelings hurt more than anything else. So if anybody didn't have the ability to get along with them, we got rid of them. We got rid of one medical officer, pure and simply because he just looked down, looked over his nose at the Iranians. We got rid of one other because he decided he would buy some items through the we didn't have a regular post exchange or a commissary, but we did have a what they call a mailing service, so we get our mail stuff in without paying a large import tax on it. So and it's such a silly thing, he didn't make a total of $50. But once we found out that he was involved in that, we knocked him on to the other. Huh. We leery of someone overstepping the bounds and making a mess. But it wasn't a problem.
Now, how much interaction was there between the officers at Amish Mag, on the staff, and the civilian population generally? They tend to be isolated, or they tend to
be... Just the opposite. Yeah. It wasn't isolation at all. It was a relationship that was varied at certain levels. My poor wife and I were just in a complete hassle all the time because the demand was far greater than we wanted and considerably greater than we could accommodate. Because basically I think we figured that we were in five different groups that intermingled some but were always having their own thing. Of course, we had the U.S. military, we had the Iranian military, we had the Shah and his group, we had the embassy, U.S. embassy group, and we had the so-called commercial, non-Iranian commercial group that were always after something. So socially, we were just in a flat spin. I know my secretary always kept a run on social accountings and what have you. And not counting the affairs that we had at our home, we averaged about 40 social affairs a month, which meant that for many nights we went to more than one. Just put in an appearance.
What?
So the social requirement from the quote formal setup was quite demanding on the top people. As you came down to the major and lieutenant colonel level, and basically all of our advisors were supposed to be majors or above. We had a few captains, but not many. As you came down to the majors and lieutenant colonels, they, in a very short time, set up relationships and friendships among the groups that were just like they had at home. And they were play bridge, go to the movies, go to dances, this, that, and other. So the contact was continuous and somewhat friendly.
With the Iranian population, okay. People in Tehran.
Mm-hmm. But very, very largely just the Iranian military. There were fair number of civilians, but basically the military.
Did any of the officers speak Persian?
A few. Mm-hmm. All of us learned a few words, but it's a strange language, very strange. In my travels, I learned to do reasonably well in German, French, Spanish. I kidded, so I could even talk to people in England a little bit. But I never could get my ear tuned in Okinawa, in Vietnam, or in Iran. I pick up phrases, but I never could follow a sentence. But this General Patton that I mentioned, the Army man, when he left, he stood up and gave them a 10-minute goodbye speech completely in Persian.
That's right.
Mm-hmm. Persian language.
Mm-hmm. Interesting. Now, you mentioned that you met frequently with the ambassador, wherever that happened to be at any given time.
Sure.
But I've read that besides those kinds of meetings at the top level, I've read that there wasn't too much interaction between the military people and the MAG and the diplomatic mission. How true is that? That there wasn't too much contact or interaction, I'd say at the lower levels or the middle levels of both organizations.
That's probably a true statement. I, along with my older general officers, were habitually included in the official diplomatic state functions. But the lesser ranks weren't very much. and it wasn't by design, it was just a matter of couldn't accommodate very many. And when you have a dignitary in, he sort of expects the more ranking people to be present. And so it wasn't a matter of sloughing them off. I know shortly after I got over there and I saw the requirements, they run in. Ups, of course, always have an apartment. Yeah, and they have big ones. They have great big. The feast is just fantastic. But they would always invite me, General Price, and General Pratt. So I went to them and told them that we certainly enjoyed being with them, appreciated the invitation. I asked them how they would feel when they were giving one of their big parties. Now, if it was something small and special, that was a different thing. When they were giving one of their big parties for 200 or 300 people, instead of sending invitations to individuals, I asked them how they would feel if they just sent me an invitation. Here's an invitation for you and 6 couples or 8 couples or something like that. I thought it was a great idea, and in a very short time I found myself always including one of each rank down the line, a man with his wife, and that brought in the lesser ranks to the formal things and worked very nicely. But you're right, the embassy never did habitually invite the working level embassy person and the working level military. But it wasn't a matter of animosity of anything. I guess just a situation.
Now, at our last meeting, you mentioned the names of some of the top military officials in Iran, General Azari, Khatami, Tufanian, among others. Now, how well did you get to know any of these people, or others I haven't named?
We were in each other's homes, with each other's families, a couple times a week, quite frequently. So I think I know them, I know their children, I know them quite well. General Azari, that you mentioned, his daughter lives right around the corner over here now. She's a PhD of psychiatry. Admiral Rasai, that might have been the name you were thinking about. Admiral Rasai was the original Navy commander when I arrived over there. Admiral Rasai's 2 daughters are both electronics engineers of all things. They live here. And Admiral Rasai is visiting here in town this week.
If you can generalize about this, but how able did you think these people were? Or as officers?
That's a rather difficult question for me to answer. If you say, how do they compare with an equal rank of a U.S. military officer, I'd say there is no comparison. It's just not fair to even try to compare them. But if you say, take this major who is operating in a relatively narrow field and has been schooled in that field, I would say he was quite competent, very good. He understood his people, he knew how to respond to his people, he could work with them. So I think their competence was at a very, very acceptable level. Their broadened comprehension, things of that sort, were quite limited. And our...
What do you mean by that?
Well, when we've spoken several times about the Army Aviation Program being the largest and the most dynamic and the one with the driving time requirement and things of that sort. We did a lot of studies. We had a lot of field training teams and this, that, and the other. And once the decision of what kind of airplane to buy and all this was concerned, we decided to get an Iranian group and send them to the United States and let them visit units that were working with those particular helicopters, see how they were used, go to places where they were maintained, even go to where they were manufacturing them, and things of that sort. So I have a group here in Washington working on the visit. They sent a schedule over, and it just threw the Iranians and me into a flat spin, because it was just, for us, a very impossible schedule. In that, and for instance, I remember one day in particular, they said, now at 9 o'clock we will have one seminar on engines, one seminar on electronics, we'll have another one on the airframe, and they had 4 or 5 seminars set up at the same time, and there was no question but what, from the Iranian standpoint, the people going to the seminars were all the same people. Any one of the seminars took everybody they had. They just didn't have enough people to go around. They hadn't developed up to a level, and everybody was trying to learn everything at one time, which it just counted to my specialist that I just mentioned. What they were trying their best to do was to get a base of individuals who understood the inner workings of all these requirements. But they couldn't respond to what the U.S. was trying to do for them, because all of their technicians were trying to learn everything at one time. So it was just a hodgepodge for a while, and it took us a long time to work through.
Now, observers of Iranian culture have noted a strong degree of, I guess, individualistic behavior and sort of a lack of a cooperative ethos. To what degree was that true with the military men with whom you worked?
I only noticed that, I think, in the medical profession. They had a medical psychology that was somewhat different from ours. A man that was a specialist, and a recognized specialist, sort of felt like, I've got something that I know, other people don't know it, and I'm going to capitalize on it, and I'm not very anxious to bring in a new man and let him grow and be in position to replace me. So there was something of a jealousy in the medical field as far as the pilots, the mechanical engineers, the communication specialists, and things of that sort. I didn't notice that attitude at all. If anything, the Iranian culture had driven into them in the last 12 years the requirement to learn. This white revolution was an emotional thing. It just spread through the culture. Everybody was encouraged to learn. I might have already mentioned to you that an automobile mechanic that had a 10th grade education.
Yeah, you talked about that. Yeah.
Had a salary. The same mechanic with 12th grade education drew more money. So everybody was trying to learn. And it wasn't a matter of learning at the expense of someone else. It wasn't a matter of learning more than someone else. Everybody was. You could go out, walk around on Sunday afternoon and see not just dozens, but hundreds of young people going to walk with a book in their hands, studying as they walked. It was just habitual to see people studying. Now, they studied, from our standpoint, in an improper manner. They were learning by rote. They overplayed the requirement for rote. But knowing their culture, that might have been broken at that time. But they still wanted to study, and as far as the skills being compartmented, as far as lack of coordination or cooperation among individuals or among units, I don't think that's a fair accusation at all. I think they were at least on par with us.
Okay. I mean, you mentioned last time that Shaw told you at times that he could not get his ministers to speak frankly with him about various policy issues and things that came up in meetings. How true was that of the military leaders?
Very true.
Very true. Same problem.
You could go in among any group, any size group. There were 12 of them, 30 of them, that sort of number. You couldn't have a substantive exchange of ideas with anybody except the senior man there. Everybody else kept quiet. Now that's true in the Far East, just as it is in the Middle East. It's a characteristic. It's magnified by the type government they have, the monarchy government. It's also true in Japan to some extent. It's very true in Korea. It's true in Vietnam. It's true in China. If you get a group of people together, the senior man does the talk, period. And they have a lot of little quirks, little things that identify the senior man. I used to just crawl the walls every time they had a formal military formation. It was just like three-act play, Mickey Mouse style. They would go out there and they'd line up the people, whether they were senior officers or whether they were military riflemen or what it was. They'd line up everybody and get the formation so that the troop commander thought it was absolutely perfect. And he waited for the senior man to arrive, without exception. I never saw it fail. When the senior man arrived, he made a slight change in the formation. He may have moved the troop line 6 inches, a half of a step, forward, back, right, left, just wiggled it around. He did it pure and simply to let everybody know that he was senior, he had arrived. Now, that same philosophy applies whether you're at a formal dinner, a cocktail party, a conference, a commander's meeting. People wait until the senior man expresses himself, and then they in effect say yes. Yes, sir. It's their culture. And it was one thing that I worked on that one subject more than anything else. And I mentioned it to the Shah time and time and time again, that he would never have any flexibility in his military until he encouraged his junior leaders to be decisive. Force your junior leaders to think. Encourage them to express themselves. Show them that it is not fatal to make a mistake.
Well, how did he respond to that kind of suggestion?
He listened very politely, and I think he believed me, because I saw several cases where he had made a special effort to try to get that point across. We didn't succeed. I mean, we made a little bit of progress, but not much. We didn't make much of a difference.
Did any of the military leaders that you talked about, Azari and Kapani and so forth, did any of them have any real influence with the Shah in terms of influence of their ideas on his thinking?
I think they did. Oh, yes. Oh,
yeah.
Yes.
Yeah.
I mentioned several times, good many times, that the most marvelous thing that I observed about the Shah was there was a man that had been a king for 30, 35 years and still had the ability to listen. When he had a subject, or when General Azhari or General Khatami or General Tufani was the most outspoken of all of them, but when he had them come in, he asked them to tell him, and they would speak. They would talk, and he would listen. He wouldn't interrupt. He would listen to them. So yes, he got ideas from them on that. But any time there was an indication that the Shah was ready to express himself, or the Shah had come to a conclusion, the discussion was terminated, I think. not because the Shah said it was terminated, but because they thought he was ready. They thought he had the information, all that they were going to be able to give.
This was your own observation at the meetings?
Oh, yes. And I met with the general officers almost every day. And I met with the Shah on a very regular basis, but if you wanted to spell it out, twice a week, something like that. So I was in and out quite frequently.
How loyal do you think the military leaders were to the Shah? I mean, did you ever hear any criticisms of the Shah from them?
Not even the slightest inkling. The nearest to a criticism I think I ever heard was one time General Khatami would come in and we'd talk with Shah a good bit. Most of the time I went in by myself, but this was something that was Special Air Force thing, and he already had a meeting set up with General Cotton, and at the last minute I was asked to go in with him. We went in, Shaw was telling him he wanted him to do this, he wanted him to do that, and they came to saw them. One agreement, it was a statement that this would be done, and that would be done on the schedule and whatever. When we came out, General Cotton looked at me and he says, His Imperial Majesty expects so much of us, and we really want to do what he wants. He said, but someday I'm going to have to get up enough nerve to tell him I just can't quite do it that fast. That's the nearest I have. Even the inkling of an uncertainty. On all other instances, when Shah expressed himself, that was it. Period. No more discussion. So I've given you a double answer there, kind of a waffle answer, and I didn't intend to. He did get ideas from his people, but he didn't get any ideas from them that they thought conflicted with his views.
So that's what the framework he established. Okay. Now, during our last meeting, in the discussion of the Nixon-Kissinger visit in May 72,
yes.
You mentioned that they, Nixon and Kissinger, agreed with the Shah that Iran should play a major role in stabilizing the Persian Gulf and parts of the Indian Ocean. Now, when you met with the Shah during this period, 71, 72, to what extent did you encourage or perhaps reinforce in his mind this view that he should play this kind of a role in the region?
That was not in my contract. It just wasn't in my feet. I did not take a stand. Either way, it's not my business. My business was to help him accomplish what my government and he wanted to do. I was not in the policy. I never made even the slightest clue of you ought to extend down in the Indian Ocean or you ought to do that. No, that was not there. I just didn't get into that.
Okay. Now, to what extent did you believe that the Iranian armed forces, as they were constituted, could accomplish the task the Shah and Nixon had in mind?
I'm not sure I know specifically what Nixon and Kissinger had in mind. So I have to be a little careful there.
Yeah.
But as far as the Shah's ideas were concerned, I thought he was very, very capable of doing just exactly what he told me he wanted to do up to one point. As you recall, he wanted to defend his borders against a neighbor, and he wanted to be able to have a delaying scorched earth policy against the Russians. There was no question in my mind but what he could, in fact, do that.
They had the capacity to do that?
Yes, I thought he could. But I didn't question that at all. Now, as time went on, and I'm not really sure now whether it was before or after the Nixon visit, they began talking about extending influence, maintaining surveillance down in the Indian Ocean to the 10th parallel. He did not have that capability. He began developing it on a somewhat grandiose basis. He started building the tri-service base at Chabahar. Chabahar is a natural harbor south of the entranceway to the Persian Gulf. So that was an open passage to the Indian Ocean. He started building that base, and that's a story within itself. It gives you a lot of understanding of their thinking. But anyway, that base was to be set up so that it would accommodate and support ocean-going ships and logistics and long-range reconnaissance aircraft, plus fighter defensive aircraft, and an armored ground force to defend the base. So it was developing into a very intricate, very big, modern base. If he had finished that job, then in my judgment, he would have been able to extend his influence on down into the Indian Ocean. He could not have fought much down there. It wouldn't have been much of a fight. His fighter planes could have extended a few hundred miles maybe. But he would have been able to give us this so-called AWACS, Aircraft Warning Control System. He would have been able to give us a, thus meaning the friendly forces, much broader capability than we had at the time. But as far as fighting Iraq, or possibly Turkey, or Pakistan, or Afghanistan, no question about it. I thought he could do a real good job of it. Mm-hmm.
Excuse me. Now, we were talking about some of the regional issues in a broad sense, but I have some more specific questions about the Shah and the Persian Gulf. Now, I think the last meeting, I mean, the meeting before that, I'm not sure, you talked about the Shah and the capture of the Tums Islands in, I think in late 71. Fall 71, something like that.
Yes.
And the next year, 72 and 73, Iran also played a role in combating an insurgency in Dhofar province in Oman.
Yes.
And in 73, the Shah assisted the Sultan of Oman by sending in combat troops. How much did the Shah talk to you or tell you about these interventions?
He did not mention Oman to me at any time. He told me the Tom's Island operation, before the operation, told me how it was going to be conducted, all that. He never mentioned Oman. You know, the subject never came up, so I never brought it up.
Were there any other regional interventions besides the Tom's that you talked to? Did you discuss with you?
No. I don't know that he ever had any others. I knew of the Oman operation because I knew of several officers that went down and participated. In fact, my aide was down.
American officers?
No.
Iranian officers.
My Iranian aide
Okay.
was called out and went down for a while.
Okay.
But he never, the aide never discussed it with me, and Shah never did. I knew it wasn't any of my business, so I didn't. Never brought it.
Okay. Now, the Nixon administration's sort of general approach to Iran was partly founded on what some people call the idea of the twin pillars, the idea of Iran and Saudi Arabia cooperating with each other and sort of jointly stabilizing the Persian Gulf region.
Again, I have to repeat, that was not in my field, and I did not participate in any of those type of discussions.
Okay. Now, in 1974, the year after you left, State Department report suggested that the U.S. effort to build up, or to help build up Iranian military power, could lead to a regional military imbalance that might encourage countries like Iraq or southern Yemen to lean more heavily on the Soviets, the Soviet Union, and this would could increase arms competition in the region generally. How much concern did you have, or other officers on the MAG, have with that possibility of sort of a regional arms race being fueled by Iran's military buildup?
We didn't take that as a concern of ours. However, the knowledge that that debate was going on back home had a profound effect on us.